From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, where jobs are, people will follow. We look at Michigan's growth spots.
The Traverse City area will officially become Michigan's newest metropolitan area.
Plus, the return of H1N1 flu.
Experts around the world do not yet understand why H1N1 flu seems to be worse than what we call seasonal flu.
We talk with Detroit Zoo Director Ron Kagan.
We expect a great zoo is going to have elephants and lions and tigers, but if the elephants can't thrive, you certainly wouldn't and shouldn't knowingly continue to keep them.
And daddy blogs.
We are not just a particular doting dad with a newborn on your chest. We are of all ages. We are single dads. We are gay dads. We're granddads.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside, everyone. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for joining us. There are some 2,500 dams in Michigan. And did you know this? Nearly all of them, more than 90%, will hit or exceed their design life by 2020. In fact, the American Society of Civil Engineers gave Michigan a grade of D when it comes to the conditions of our dams. On today's show, how concerned should we be about our aging dams? Is there the money and the political will to fix them? And then later in the hour, the state's chief medical doctor stops by to explain just why this year's flu season seems to be a particularly mean one, impacting not the usual suspects. But first, as the famous quote goes, it's the economy, stupid. And the data and numbers crunchers have been busily crunching away, trying to peer into the future to figure out what lies ahead for Michigan over the next 10 years in terms of jobs and pay. And the verdict? Michigan's economic axis is tilting west. Bridge Magazine's Rick Hagland recently looked at this shift. Welcome back to Stateside, Rick.
Good to be with you.
And joining us for the conversation is Don Grimes, who's with the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. Good to have you back with us, Don.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Rick, the overall projections are indicating Michigan will have some of the slowest job gains in the nation over the next 10 years. So let's talk first about the entire state. How much job growth should we see over the next 10?
The projections, I think, are around 6% growth expected over the next 20 or 30 years.
Okay.
So fairly slow going compared to where we need to be.
Yes, but as you write and point out in your piece for Bridge, not all regions are going to fare the same. So where do we expect to see the job growth?
Well, we'll be seeing it primarily in the more urban areas of the state and also places that are near water. The biggest growth is going to be in the Grand Rapids area, the largest percentage growth. Traverse City is another hot spot, Ann Arbor. Although Detroit, Metro Detroit, the three-county region there is projected to have the slowest growth. I mean, obviously, the most gross number of jobs will be in the Metro Detroit area.
And the three regions that you talk about, West Michigan, Traverse City, and Ann Arbor, are expected to generate jobs at twice the rate of that Metro Detroit region. We're looking at 116,507 jobs to be added by 2023, and that's compared with slightly more than 71,000 in the Tri-County area. Don Grimes, why is this?
Well, I think you can really look at sort of two major aspects. One, as Rick said, is the water. And the west coast of Michigan, the lakefront property is on beaches. A lot of the east coast, if you're going up Lake Huron shore, it's a little rockier. So I think that those beaches and in the natural environment over in the west coast is a great advantage. The second is that the city of Grand Rapids appears to be much more advanced in its revitalization of the city itself than the city of Detroit. There's some evidence that the city of Detroit is turning around, but it's not nearly as far advanced as an attractive place for young professionals to live and work.
And what does that look like? What does that mean? What are they doing in Grand Rapids that is attracting these young professionals?
Well, I think there's been a really strong civic and governmental commitment to revitalizing the downtown, and it's been going on for years. And so you've sort of seen the relocation of parts of Grand Valley University to downtown Grand Rapids area, working on improving the riverfront. And I don't think you've got the same divisive sort of politics that you have in the Detroit area, including this bankruptcy, which has clearly been a setback for the city of Detroit.
Now, Don, what other obstacles are ahead when it comes to growing jobs in our state?
We're really beginning to get very tapped out in terms of our potential workforce in Michigan because of our aging of our population, which is really dramatic. I mean, Michigan is a heavy baby boomer state. In other words, we have a lot of people who are now in their 50s, in their early 60s even, and those people are going to rapidly be approaching retirement age now, even if you assume that some of them continue to work because they have to or they want to. Eventually, at some point, those people are going to be forced out of the labor force for health reasons, if no other reason. And essentially, yeah, that's going to really hurt our ability to grow jobs in 3 or 4 years and more.
And then, so that circles back to the constant battle cry of get these millennials to want to come back to Michigan and settle and work and live here.
Exactly correct. And
yeah,
that's actually, Grand Rapids is actually very successful in attracting young professional workers into the Grand Rapids area. And then, of course, that's why the entire beachfront, the lakefront, is so important, because that, again, that creates a nice natural environment that makes it attractive to young and older workers as well. You have to have a place that people want to move to in the future. That's really critical, is that the people and where they want to live is going to be the key guiding for public policymakers going out 10, 20, 30 years. It's not going to be trying to, you know, to attract these businesses to come to where your plant is. It's going to be trying to attract people to move to your state or region.
If you just joined us, that's Don Grimes, who's with the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. And he's joined with by Bridge Magazine writer Rick Hagland as we look at projections for job growth in Michigan over the next 10 years. And your piece in Bridge, Rick, really covers so many of these areas as far as West Michigan, Grand Rapids, and Traverse City and Ann Arbor. And I'm wondering what Don had just referred to about the baby boomers and retiring. I know a lot of folks, Rick, who've retired in Traverse, or they intend to. And you wonder, what does that mean for companies who need to hire workers? Could that really hit that Traverse area and slow it down?
Yes, it could. You know, Traverse City, as you mentioned, has really become kind of an attractive place for retirees. On the other end, you know, a fair number of younger people want to live there as well. And part of it, you know, part of it has to do with the attractive natural resources up there being on the bay. But the other thing that's going on in Traverse City is it's becoming a more urban area. And the projections are that the Traverse City area will officially become Michigan's newest metropolitan area when the next census is taken in 2020. So it's got things going for it. It's kind of a foodie town. It's a bit of a tech town. It's a, you know, a craft beer and wine, you know, winery sort of thing that,
yeah,
that attracts younger workers. And I think they're focusing on that to try to attract more of a younger workforce there.
That was Rick Hagland from Bridge Magazine, and he was joined by Don Grimes with the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. Well, it's now day two of the Media Preview Week at the North American International Auto Show at Cobo Center in Detroit. The show gives the auto industry a chance to strut its stuff and showcase its latest models. But Toyota is going a step further. The automaker is promoting its cars to drivers who like computer video games with an automotive theme. And that means gamers can effectively test drive the new models. The BBC's business correspondent Russell Padmore sent us this report.
So the winner of the truck of the year, and I can say truck now, is the Chevy Silverado 1500.
While General Motors was taking the prizes in Detroit for Chevy's new Silverado truck, the sales team at Toyota focused on sports cars, putting the finishing touches to a strategy to promote its brand to PC gamers. The carmaker has enlisted the help of fellow Japanese company Sony to unveil its concept sports car, giving video games players a chance to take a virtual drive in the FT1 on their PlayStation. Development of the FT1 started 2 years ago, and from today, Toyota says it will be a downloadable vehicle for PlayStation 3 Gran Turismo 6. Drivers in the online world are being challenged to finish in the top three of a virtual race before they download the virtual FT1. Back in the real world, in Detroit, Toyota is keeping technical details of its concept car under wraps. But the prototype's engine is in the front, with the window in the hood showing off the motor underneath. The future Toyota, or FT1, signals a change in the Japanese company's conservative strategy of product development, usually aimed at taking fewer risks. Now, encouraging computer gamers to take a virtual drive will help to measure what motorists think of the next generation of Toyota cars.
That report from the BBC's business correspondent, Russell Padmore. Governor Rick Snyder toured the auto show today. He points out the fact Michigan manufactured more than 2 million cars last year, a nation-leading number that's more than double the industry's dark days of 2009 and the highest level since 2005. And it's likely we'll hear more touting of the auto industry's success on Thursday. That's when Vice President Joe Biden is set to tour the show. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is the number one paid tourist attraction here in Michigan, the Detroit Zoo, drawing more than a million visitors each and every year. The zoo first opened its doors in 1883, but its mission has evolved tremendously since those early days, shifting from animal care to animal welfare. In fact, the Detroit Zoo is a leader in animal conservation and welfare, and that's largely in part because of the zoo's executive director, Ron Kagan. I recently spoke with Kagan and asked him, as he goes to work every single day, what's his personal mission?
Well, certainly the stated mission is celebrating and saving wildlife, and I think we take that very seriously. Part of our job is saving literally the animals that live here, but also it's to try to help save animals and their homes in the wild. And so I think all of us here approach our work feeling a lot of pride and a lot of joy, but also, frankly, feeling some heavy responsibility because it is squarely on our shoulders to make a difference.
And maybe to make a decision that maybe at first blush someone might say, why did they do that? For example, when you gave up the elephants on ethical grounds in 2005, you made some major headlines.
You know, it actually is amazing in life. Common sense generally is a great thing to embrace. And we have been struggling, as had many, many other zoos, for decades with elephant welfare issues. And we just said, look, we have to talk to our community about this so that this can't be a secret any longer. And B, we've got to find a way that either dramatically improves their situation, or we just need to stop doing it. I mean, mm-hmm. We can't do everything. Nobody can. And in the end, obviously, that was the decision we made. And when we talked to Metro Detroit, we found a wonderful understanding after a very short conversation explaining the challenges. The public said, well, we expect a great zoo is going to have elephants and lions and tigers, but if the elephants can't thrive, you certainly wouldn't and shouldn't knowingly continue to keep them. And we said, yeah, that's what we think too. It's interesting to note that the Toronto Zoo just sent their elephants to the sanctuary that we sent ours to some 7 or 8 years ago. So, there certainly are some other zoos that are also facing similar situations and in some cases taking the same action.
I'm speaking with Ron Kagan, the executive director and the chief executive officer of the Detroit Zoo, which is really a zoo that's become a leader in animal conservation and welfare. And your species survival plans are very important in that. Tell us how you're saving endangered species with these efforts.
Well, it's a terrific collaborative effort among the accredited zoos in the U.S. There are about 220 accredited zoos and aquariums. We are one of them. We work with all of the others. And so rather than thinking about animals as objects and possessive and ownership and things like that, we basically think about what's best for the population and for the individual animals, and especially those that are endangered. So the breeding programs are done in a cooperative way. Animals are moved to different places to make sure that the genetics of any population are healthy. The hope, of course, is with many of them to be able to ultimately release back into the wild when areas are safe. And there have been some species where that has indeed occurred.
You know, around the recent headlines surrounding the Detroit Institute of Arts in connection with the Detroit bankruptcy filing, I'm guessing brings back some memories of dark days for the zoo, because it was early 2006 when Detroit City Council voted to shut down the zoo as part of its budget cuts. That was a real close brush with death, wasn't it?
Well, fortunately, the region and the community didn't need to be asked more than once about whether the zoo is worth keeping. And the zoo should be a regional asset, and if it's a regional asset, it requires everybody to pitch in. The current situation with the city obviously is, you know, challenging for many. We still don't know for sure exactly how or if this will impact us. The city owns the property. And technically owns the animals, but the animals are really a liability. They're not a financial asset. It doesn't seem to be a way for the city to monetize the zoo, so I doubt very much that there is any significant threat to the viability of the zoo because of the bankruptcy.
Ron Kagan, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
You too. Thanks so much.
Ron Kagan is Executive Director and Chief Executive Officer of the Detroit Zoo. Okay, sometimes running a family, a household with kids, can feel like a zoo. And the media tends to put lots of attention on the role of moms in all of this. But how about some respect for dads? How about we stop with the marketing and entertainment cliches portraying dad as a big old doofus who can't boil a pot of water or change a nasty diaper? And how about we start recognizing the fact that men play a very active role in home life? Well, that's been the mission of my next guest. He's been one of the nation's leading daddy bloggers ever since launching his blog, Laid Off Dad. That was over 10 years ago. And in July 2010, he created another blog, When the Flames Go Up, blogging with his ex-wife about co-parenting after divorce. And he's the co-founder of the upcoming Dad 2.0 Summit, which aims to raise the profile of dads in the eyes of companies and marketers. Ann Arbor-based Doug French, welcome to Stateside.
Well, it's great to be here.
You know, it does seem that doofus dad was such a key part of sitcoms and commercials, even going back to the 60s. Is it really still true today that doofus dad is all too present in American media?
Well, I think the pendulum is switching back where it belongs. I mean, I think you look at dads in the 40s and 50s when dad was the unimpeachable authority. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the essence of humor is to poke fun at the most authoritative figure. So when that goes to the extreme and you get dads who are completely helpless and clueless and checked out, it reaches a point where you see a point of limited return and you think, wait a minute, let's get the needle back in the center and recognize that the best parenthood is partnership.
And that is what you've been trying to preach as you've been blogging, and you've been doing it since 2003. And I'm kind of curious, since you launched Laid Off Dad, how has the blogosphere changed in that time?
Well, yeah, it feels antediluvian to be having blogged as long as I have. It's been amazing. Obviously, you know, we have a template to go by. We are, you know, the moms have been at this for a long time.
They have indeed.
I mean, the joke is we grew out of Eve's rib, basically, because Mom 2.0 has been a conference now for 5 years.
Okay.
And 3 years ago in New Orleans, we had a track at Mom 2.0 solely about dad-based material. Mm-hmm. So to posting blogs, obviously the quantity has blown up, and the commercial opportunities have blown up as well. And we're about that, obviously. We do have a business bent to us in terms of trying to monetize and create relationships that help you sustain your blog and help your voice stay in the conversation.
But, which the mommy bloggers have done very well at.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we do have that with that goal. But before you sell a blog, you have to find your voice as a writer.
And who are these? Who are you? Were one of the first, and there are more. The field is more crowded now with mm-hmm. men doing dad blogs. Who are they? And is there much diversity in this crowd?
Absolutely. I think you'll find, and that's, and again, one of the panels we're going to have at Dad 2.0 this year is about how we are not just a particular doting dad with a newborn on your chest. We are of all ages. We are single dads. We are gay dads. We're granddads. Parenthood is an adventure regardless of gender, and I think you see dads all over who are not only from very diverse backgrounds but also producing a diverse level of content in terms of podcasts and vlogs and Small shorts. We have a. You'll see. There's a. We have a media partner, Parents Magazine, who just partnered with some really entertaining actors who run and do a couple of shorts called "Lords of the Playground," about dads in the playground, and it's wonderful, and it's we all aim for the point where at some point it just won't be a big deal. It won't be a novel thing to see a dad on the playground taking care of his kids in a way that's any kid, any parent would want.
And isn't that funny? It's kind of the other side of where women wanted it to be, that it wasn't a novel thing to see a woman in a boardroom or a woman in a laboratory. It's just, I'm here as a worker, and you're trying to say, we're here as a parent.
I think it dovetails very well. I think it's very similar, the whole idea of let's just recognize not only are there no traditional roles, they've been gone for a long time. And what's especially encouraging is that younger families and new dads and new moms, they're just making decisions based upon what works best for them. And that's the way, that's the inevitable change, I think, that there'll be a point where it doesn't matter who wins the most bread or who's the you're going to find the best job for the best person, divide and conquer, and play to your strengths.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with blogger Doug French, who's been writing Laid Off Dad for over 10 years now. He also has another blog, When the Flames Go Up. He blogs with his ex-wife about co-parenting after divorce, and the co-founder of the upcoming Dad 2.0 Summit. So what is the whole point of this summit?
Well, I think first and foremost, The best part of the internet is to use it to find your tribe, to find people with shared interests, shared passions. And people can walk away from a conference like this and put a face to a name. And so not only do you make friends and get emboldened in your passion and your and recognize that this sort of thing is possible, but you also make relationships that you couldn't make over an email. You can because when you're finding a partner to work with on a business aspect of it, you can sit down with someone and see, is this a person I want to work with? And you'll see all the different dads who do all the different things. But if you there's thousands of them of men who identify in some way as a dad, and I think that's a powerful thing. And so I think as far as the conference goes, it stands for finding your people and finding ways to sustain your business and walk away just catalyzed to walk away inspired. To either to start something you were thinking about or to build on what you've already built.
It's also a chance to show the marketers of America just who the tribe is.
Right, exactly.
And have things changed? Have you seen things that you could point to where you go, okay, that company has gotten with the 21st century?
Well, yeah, the example that I love to trot out, and again, to belabor the issue with Kimberly Clark, but we had a wonderful experience with Huggies a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And they shot an ad campaign, and initially the plan was we put our diapers to the ultimate challenge, dads. You know, dads were home alone with their kids for 5 days, and the wives were saying, I don't know if he can handle it. And as is mostly the case, their ad campaign was associated with a Facebook page, and there was a lot of feedback.
Or saying, pushback, perhaps?
Exactly. Blowback.
Blowback, yes.
Saying, you know, dads are saying, why are you treating me this way? And the moms are saying, why are you treating my husband this way? This is the man I married, and he's actually quite capable.
Hello, marketers.
Exactly. And I think that there are other brands this had happened to in the past, and they kind of ducked. They kind of said, we'll just wait this out, and it'll be over soon. Huggies didn't do that. Huggies said, we have to confront this. And so the Thursday before our first conference, I got a call from their PR firm saying, would it be okay if I brought three brand managers down from Kimberly Clark to Austin, where our first conference was, to have one-on-one conversations with dads? And I just kind of, you know, held the phone away from my ear and jumped up and down for a few minutes and said, yeah, I think I could do that. I'll carry you from the hotel if I have to, because that's what we need. That's what we're here for, conversations with brands and marketers and bloggers. And they came, and they had all kinds of footage that they just tweaked a little bit. And now you'll see ads that are talking about dads wiping their kids' mouths with the spaghetti sauce that they had created. You know, I just made this meal for my son, and now I'm testing to see if these things are working well for me. Total transformation, and they've been a big part of our family ever since. So it's been a great move for them, too. It was a win-win because they confronted this. They had a conversation with us, and it's they've been a big part of our lives ever since then as a big brand that had a – didn't take much for a big shift. And these guys were all dads, too. All three men who came down and said,
you know, I get this.
Yeah. What were we thinking?
I'm interested in how your blog, Laid Off Dad, has evolved. You launched it when you were indeed a laid off dad, right?
Yes.
You had time on your hands, home with the boys.
Right.
Tell us a little about what content that you've been putting into it and how it's changed as the boys grow, your marriage ends, you're now, you're co-parenting with your ex-wife. How's that content changed?
Well, it's been remarkable, actually. I mean, I'm at the point now where I'm actually looking to see where my voice is going to be, because things were very different when I started.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing that's been maintained throughout this is that my two favorite things in the world are being a dad and writing. So that's not going to change. If anything, this job that I have now, which I love, in fact, that's the joke. I mean, I was laid off from three jobs in a row, so I made one up.
There you go.
And but I think that, yes, as my marriage ended, as my second child was born, I mean, when I started, my older son was 15 months old. And by the time my second son was born, I'd gotten a bit of fame. And so when you announce that you're having another child, mm-hmm. things went bananas. And then when I announced I was divorcing, and there were hundreds of comments on there saying, "We're so sorry, we like you both," because my mm-hmm. ex-wife is a blogger as well.
Yes.
And that was the coolest part, was when I would say that I could say thank you for showing your support, because one of the main things I started the blog for was as a legacy to my kids. I would love it if I could read what was going through my dad's head when I was born.
Good point.
If I had a journal of what was going on in my dad's mind in the 60s. Yes, I'm that old. So one day my kids are going to read this blog start to finish, and they're going to know that when their parents divorced, hundreds of people expressed their faith in us, their support,
their concern,
their sorrow, their concern, but also saying such things as coming to know you as we have through your wonderful writing. We know your kids are going to be okay.
That is a gift.
And even when I think about this now, I get kind of a little verklempt, because that's a powerful thing that helped me. The people I'd met through my blog who have led through the support staff, my support, so much of my support through my divorce, who have helped me create Dad 2.0, who have helped me go on to speak at other conferences and talk about dads, all because 10 years ago I thought I'd love to be able to write like this. It's the opportunities and friendships are the most profound blessing I've ever, apart from my kids themselves, that's the most profound blessing in my life.
Meantime, knowing you have a tweenager, your readers, the readers of Laid Off Dad, are probably in for a real treat as that tweenager goes hightailing right through those teen years.
Well, yeah. Boy, I can't wait.
Doug French is the blogger behind Laid Off Dad and When the Flames Go Up. And it has been a pleasure meeting you and speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
So what are your thoughts? Do you think men are portrayed unfairly in marketing and in the media? Share your thoughts with us. You can go to Facebook and look for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And, of course, always on the web at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's beginning to make its presence felt in empty chairs at the workplace, in sad little Facebook status updates saying, "All right, it got me. I'm sick." Flu season is upon us. Federal officials report 35 states are now experiencing widespread influenza activity, with young and middle-aged adults being hit hardest this year, rather than the usual pattern of seniors or children. So let's start with the flu season and find out what it looks like here in Michigan as we welcome Dr. Matthew Davis, Chief Medical Executive for the State Health Department and, of course, a professor at the University of Michigan. Good to have you with us, Doctor.
Good to be here.
What are we seeing in Michigan? What's worrying doctors most this year?
What's really come at us just in the past 3 to 4 weeks now is a flood of cases of what's known as H1N1 influenza. Our listeners may recognize that name, H1N1, as the pandemic flu virus that was all of a sudden hitting countries around the globe back in 2009 and 2010.
Remember it so well, pictures of people in the Far East with masks everywhere, and there was H1N1, I think, is branded on many brains.
And it was bad here in Michigan as well, mm-hmm. where we had one of the toughest seasons we've ever had for flu in the past 10 years. And as you noted before, it affected younger and middle-aged adults who generally think of themselves as healthy and probably not at too much risk for getting severe flu illness.
So what kind of incidents are we seeing throughout the state at this point?
What we're seeing is above the usual level of people going to the doctor's office and emergency rooms with flu-like symptoms, first of all. We know there's a lot of flu activities in our communities across the state. Number two, and this is what's even more concerning, we're seeing hospitalizations for previously healthy individuals, in some cases needing life support. And that level of intensity of care is something that we've really only seen recently back in 2009, 2010, when H1N1 was here.
And as you were saying, when we're looking at the fact that it's more of the middle-aged and younger adults getting hit versus seniors, we have that idea that if someone is medically frail and is a senior, it's kind of not a surprise that they might wind up on life support at a hospital. But this is a kind of a new curveball.
This is a curveball that we saw for the first time back in 2009 and 2010, and we're seeing it again. The good news for this is that back in 2009, 2010, groups at the University of Michigan that specialize in a special form of life support called ECMO, or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. It's essentially a heart and lung bypass machine for critically ill people. We're very helpful in helping other hospitals, not only across the state, but across the country and around the world, take up ECMO for adults. ECMO was originally started at the University of Michigan by Dr. Bob Bartlett, who started it for neonates, for babies who were just born, and then it extended out to kids and then into adults. So adults are actually the last group to get the benefit of this particular type of life-saving technique. It turns out since 2009, we've seen more use in adults for ECMO than we've ever seen before. And that was all prompted by our national experience with H1N1 back a few years ago.
What can you tell us about what H1N1 does to the body that explains this development where we're seeing not the very young and the very old, but the middle-aged to younger adults? What happens in the body because of H1N1?
In general, when we see a very severe case of flu that sends somebody to the hospital or especially puts them on life support, we're seeing an overwhelming infection in the lungs where the body's immune response, its own natural response to the infection, is so strong that there's a lot of fluid that's released into the lungs, and it's like trying to breathe underwater, which, as we know, doesn't work so well if we're humans. So that's why we end up with people in the intensive care unit. And if that problem is worsened by other organ systems that are not working as well, for example, the heart or the circulatory system, sometimes people need advanced life support to make it through that severe illness.
But why is it hitting that age group in the center bubble as opposed to the opposite ends?
If we had a good answer to that, we'd be years ahead. Experts around the world do not yet understand why H1N1 flu seems to be worse than what we call seasonal flu, the other types of influenza that we generally see each year. That's what makes prevention so important. And as a primary care doctor through the U of M health system and as the state's chief medical executive, I really encourage people to go out and get vaccinated even this season. Although we're starting to see cases of the flu, we get protection from vaccination within just 2 weeks, and we're likely to see a long flu season this time around.
So heading out to get a vaccination now would put you in good stead for the flu season to come, because this is going to play out for weeks.
We expect it to, based on the pattern we saw back in 2009, 2010, which lasted for several months. The great story about this year's flu vaccine, Cindy, is that although experts have to guess every February which circulating flu strains will be present the following season, they guessed right on the money this year. And so you've got H1N1 flu in the vaccine, and then two or even up to three other strains, and those strains are exactly the ones that are circulating in our communities.
And there's plenty of vaccine around, so we don't have shortages?
There's plenty of vaccine around at the national level. To the extent we have counts available at the state level, we expect that there are truly tens, if not hundreds of thousands of doses of vaccine in doctors' offices, pharmacies, and other locations in our communities.
I just saw a report today, Doctor, that finds that when you look at the total percent of children and adults who were vaccinated for flu in last year, Michigan's tied with Mississippi for 41st place. And then you look at adults 18 and over, we're 46th. Why are we such laggards in getting that flu shot?
That is a challenge here in Michigan in terms of the mindset. I don't know whether it's a Midwestern, we'll make it through, just bring it on type of attitude about flu, or it's a sense that maybe there won't be as much benefit as I would want from flu. Let me just try to take my chances. Either way, flu is nothing to mess with. And we're seeing that this year with the severe illnesses in previously healthy individuals. and a situation where we actually have a vaccine that is perfectly matched to the strains that are going around. There is no more effective vaccine against flu than the one we have this year.
And what do you say to people, and I've worked with people who say, I don't get a flu shot because it'll give me the flu.
The flu shot does not have any flu virus in it. It is a killed vaccine that builds your immunity to flu by exposing your immune system to particular proteins. Those are the H's and the N's that we hear about in the names of these flu bugs. So when your body is stimulated by the vaccine against those proteins, then it'll react to the flu virus if you're exposed to it.
We should make sure that we get your expertise and have you explain to one and all when we need to feel that what we're feeling is flu. How do we know it's not just I ate something or I'm getting a cold versus this could be H1N1?
That's a natural question. In fact, we know that right about now, especially in long-term care environments like nursing homes, there are actually cases of norovirus going around that you may have heard of on cruise ships in the summertime.
Yes.
Those are common also in very contained care settings like nursing homes in the wintertime. We're seeing that here in Michigan, and some people might interpret that as, quote, unquote, the stomach flu.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually a different illness that unfortunately we don't have a vaccine for yet.
Mm-hmm.
The flu, as in influenza, really has a couple key components that I listen for when I'm listening to my patients talk about their symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, you often do have some congestion in your nose and throat, perhaps a sore throat as well. Number two, there's often a cough that goes with that. And fever is a very common element of the flu. If you don't have fever, the chances that you have influenza are very low. Furthermore, if you have body aches, that's very uncommon with a common cold or with norovirus, a GI illness, gastrointestinal illness. And so body aches are very common with influenza itself.
Dr. Matthew Davis, who's professor at the University of Michigan and chief medical executive for the State Health Department. A pleasure to have your insights and your advice. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
And we asked you today on Facebook, what do you do to keep the flu away? Frank says raw garlic with a raw honey chaser. Margie says vitamins D, C, and zinc every day. Chris says don't touch your face without washing your hands. Grab door handles in the least grabbed spot and hit elevator buttons with your knuckle. And finally, Jeremy told us, and I quote him here, transfusions of shark blood. I'm assuming Jeremy was joking, I think. There are nearly 2,600 dams in Michigan, and nearly all of them, more than 90%, will hit or exceed their design life by 2020. That's according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. In fact, it gave Michigan a grade of D on the condition of its dams. My next guest looked into this issue of Michigan's aging dams in a piece in the Detroit Free Press, where he's the environmental reporter. Keith Matheny, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, happy to be here.
That report card from the civil engineers sure isn't anything to brag about. So just how concerned should we all be about Michigan's dams?
Well, we took a look. Obviously, these dams range in size from really, really small to the very large ones you often see, you know, creating mill ponds and things like that around communities.
Mm-hmm.
We focused our review of dams on what are called high hazard potential dams. Now, these are the dams that officials have determined were they to fail, you could expect loss of human life and significant structural damage. The state of Michigan oversees 88 such dams, and they're all throughout the state. And we found that all but six of them are approaching or past 50 years old, which is the average engineered lifespan. Now, in some cases, they've been well maintained, but more and more frequently, we're finding that these dams are no longer being used for the purpose they were initially installed for. You know, they may have been created way back in, you know, the early 1900s to, you know, run grist mills and,
sure,
and float logs and things like that. So now they're not being used for that purpose. It's costly to maintain them. The money to come by maintaining them is difficult to find. So in many cases, they've been abandoned or are not being properly maintained.
And are they distributed all around Michigan?
We saw one estimate that by the mid-20th century, so the mid-1900s, every major waterway that runs into the Great Lakes was dammed for one purpose or another. So not necessarily the high-hazard potential dams, but you can find old aging, crumbling dams almost everywhere in the state.
So what needs to happen when you think of options? There's what, repair, replace, or remove the dam altogether?
Well, there isn't much money to come by these days with
yes.
you know, government struggling with their budgets. The state of Michigan, Governor Snyder instituted a $2.35 million dam management grant program, and local governments and individuals who own dams jumped at it. Only five projects received grants, and they were, you know, to remove dams. A couple of them were to repair dams. This year, that same fund only has $350,000 in grants available, so it's significantly less than the previous year. And there was a report done for the Michigan Municipal League Foundation in 2007 highlighting the growing crisis of aging dams that indicated that there were perhaps 120 dams in the state that needed $50 million worth of repair or replacement costs.
And I got a sense from reading your piece that for homeowners who live around these dams, you explore the reaction. Obviously, on one hand, nobody wants to think they could be inundated by a flood, but you found many who are very anguished about what it would mean to remove the dam.
Well, and we had an incident. It's going back a ways now, but in 1986, there were torrential rains in the Lower Peninsula from September 10th through 15th of that year. 14 dams failed, and another 19 dams almost did, and it was catastrophic throughout the Lower Peninsula. I think six people were killed, 89 people were injured, 30,000 homes were flooded, and it caused something like $500 million in damage. So one of the things we learned is that at times like this, an old dam probably isn't as much of a threat as it would be in the spring when the rains are falling, when the snow melt is happening and the rivers swell. That's when the loads on the backs of these dams can become unbearable if they haven't been well maintained.
Although we have heard from our environmental scientists who point to the climate change and to the extreme rainstorms, for instance, that we had a lot of this past summer. So you have to wonder where that's going to go as we move into more and more of this extreme weather.
Indeed. If you have situations where there's flooding, you're going to have rivers swelling. And if you have old dams that weren't well maintained, the risk is just going to rise exponentially.
Keith, is this a story being repeated all over the country? Is Michigan one of many states where we see this as a symptom of our crumbling, aging infrastructure?
I really think it is. And as officials told me, it's not just about dams. I mean, you can look at any sort of infrastructure, bridges, roads. There's always immediate needs that can be found. So it's really a difficult political sell to talk about the needs coming down the road 10, 15, 20 years. And I think the net result of that is they're all going to kind of hit you all at once. As you mentioned at our start here, mm-hmm. 90% of our 2,600 dams will exceed their design life by 2020. It's going to become a much bigger bill.
And it makes me kind of wonder what to take away with this, particularly if you live near a dam. What do you do besides worry?
Well, one of the things that we found interesting, too, typically, you know, communities have lived around these dams for a century or more. You know, the perhaps the small lake that was created behind it, it's become part of the fabric of the community.
Yeah.
And it can be really traumatic when someone's talking about removing or replacing these dams. And you got to keep in mind that the majority of dams are owned by a private owner. So they're bearing the costs of this. They probably don't want to anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you have people all around the area affected by the dam who, you know, obviously have a big stake in what happens, but they don't really get to say whether the dam stays or goes because it's a private person bearing the costs who makes that decision.
And I gather when we talk about not a lot of money in Lansing, so the idea of enforcing upkeep and repair, who would do that?
The State Department of Environmental Quality has a dam safety division, and the law requires that dam owners themselves have engineering firms evaluate their dams. Those reports are sent to the state, and I'm told if they see something concerning, you know, they may go out and do their own reviews as well. And the DEQ doesn't really get into whether, your dam stays or goes. They just say, here's a problem. It needs to be resolved one way or the other, and that can include removal. Now, there's another state agency, the State Department of Natural Resources, that's more concerned with the fish habitat and mm-hmm. things like that. They seem to like the idea of removing some of these old dams because they think it restores a more free-flowing river and is better for fish. So that can cause interesting dynamics when you're dealing with a community that loves the way things are.
They love their mill pond. Leave it alone.
Sure.
Real interesting issue, and clearly as we see the clock tick as these dams age out, something we're going to be hearing more about. Keith Matheny, environmental reporter for the Detroit Free Press. Great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Detroit Lions have themselves a new head coach, and it is someone who's had experience in that job. Jim Caldwell will replace Jim Schwartz as the Lions head coach. Caldwell becomes the first African-American head coach in Lions history. He helped Indianapolis get to the Super Bowl after his debut season in 2009, but was fired 2 years later and then spent the past couple seasons with Baltimore the last year and a half as offensive coordinator. The Lions are expected to formally introduce Caldwell tomorrow. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Candy. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.